This is Lewis Lapham with The World in Time. My guest is the historian Timothy Snyder, speaking with us today about the political murder of 14 million people in Eastern Europe during the years 1933-1945. The killing, a joint effort on the part of the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany. Your new book, Tim, comes with the title Bloodlands, Europe Between Hitler and Stalin. Maybe you can start by telling us how you map the bloodlands. Where did the mass murder begin, and why is it that most of us don't know the story?
Well, I'm a historian of Eastern Europe, and it came to me as I entered the profession that we had a kind of dark secret. And the dark secret was that the region that we are occupied with, the region between Germany and Russia, between the Baltic and the Black Seas, is precisely the region where the tremendous majority of the deliberate mass killing of the European 20th century took place. Almost all of the German killing took place there, the Holocaust, but also the other major German crimes, which include the starvation of Soviet prisoners of war and mass execution of civilians and so-called reprisals, but also a disproportionate amount of the Soviet killing, the planned Ukrainian famine of 1932 and 1933, a great deal of the terror of 1937 to 1938, the executions of Polish citizens that we remember under the name Katyn. All of this took place in the same territory. And once I realized that, then I came to this idea of the bloodlands and to the attempt to write a history of the place and also of the time. The time is interesting as well. If you think of the place is rather small compared to the grand Eurasian empires of Hitler and Stalin. If you think of Hitler and Stalin in 1941 or 1942, say, they rule essentially from the Atlantic to the Pacific, but the killing was concentrated in this one place. You can say something similar about time. This killing takes place between 1933 and 1945, which unsurprisingly is the period that both Hitler and Stalin were in power. Why don't we know more of this? I think there are two reasons. The first is that the history of this massive destruction, of this calamity, has been divided up. It's like a black hole which then bursts into life with a big bang, and the stories spread out from each other very quickly without ever making contact again. They go off in different directions. The most important of these histories is, of course, of the Holocaust, but there are other histories that are more or less well known that involve national tragedies. They're known at least to the nations in question, like no Pole doesn't know what Katyn means. That's, of course, the execution of 22,000 Polish citizens by the Soviet NKVD in the spring of 1940. No Ukrainian doesn't know what the famine of 1933 was, and so forth. But these histories have taken on particular shapes, usually national shapes. Because we write history, even today as we speak of postmodernism and globalization and so on, we write history in national terms. I think the second reason we haven't grasped all of this has something to do with the Cold War. The Germans killed to the east of Germany. In other words, they killed in the lands which later became the Soviet Cold War Empire. So when the Iron Curtain falls, in the second half of the 1940s, it's essentially cutting off the West, not only from half of Europe, but from the graveyards of Europe, from the death pits, from the death facilities, from the places where not only were the Soviets killed, that's pretty obvious, but also from the places where the Germans killed, which means that our understanding of what happened in Europe in the 1930s and 1940s has been incomplete.
What was the political motive in the mind of Hitler on the one side and Stalin on the other side? Why did they, from the Hitler point of view, what you call the Bloodlands or the Garden of Eden, and from Stalin's point of view, it's the Promised Land. Talk about their political visions that concentrated them both on these Bloodlands.
That's a good way to put it, because each of them start with a vision, and then each of the vision is constrained to a continent, and then to a particular part of the continent, and then what's worse for the peoples concerned, it's the same part of the continent. So to start with Stalin, because with the Soviet Union is really where the mass killing begins, the Soviets, of course, begin with the idea that there's going to be a world proletarian revolution, or at least a European one, which doesn't happen. They find themselves thrown back onto the Soviet Union. They make of the Soviet Union a state. So rather than a continuing revolution, they have a state. And the problem that they have as socialists or as communists is that state is backward. They have to develop it very quickly. And so they undertake a policy which I refer to as a kind of internal colonization, which is very close to the way Stalin himself talked about it. His view was that since the Soviet Union couldn't have colonies in the outside world, what it would have to do was colonize itself from the inside. side. That meant a policy of collectivization, which meant taking farmland from free farmers and peasants and putting it under the control of the state. This proved inefficient. It led to shortfalls in food, and Stalin found people to blame for that. The most important scapegoat for Stalin was the Ukrainian nation in 1932 and 1933. And as these shortfalls spread, but as Stalin continued to want to export food in order to get investment capital, he blamed the Ukrainian nation and implemented policies which guaranteed that millions of people in Ukraine would die. Then if we move ahead a couple of years to 1937 and 1938, you see the second major act of mass killing, which is the Great Terror in the Soviet Union, which I see as a kind of retreat. Stalin has seen that his policies, although they have industrialized the country, have created a good deal of enmity in all likelihood from the population. And he's concerned that there's going to be some kind of invasion from Europe and from Asia, maybe at the same time. His actual scenario is a Japanese-Polish invasion of the Soviet Union. And fearful that foreign powers are going to ally with alienated peasants who have survived all of this, he orders the Great Terror. And the victims of the Great Terror are, first of all, workers and peasants, that is, the people the Soviet Union was supposed to help. And the second large group of victims in the Great Terror are ethnic minorities. So Stalin actually, rather than Hitler, carries out the first mass ethnic shooting actions in the Europe of the 1930s.
His purpose is to set up an empire based on the production of food. These bloodlands are where that food is going to come from, right?
That's part of the key to understanding the overlap. The Nazis and the Soviets have visions which are, so to speak, the opposite of each other, but which both involve Ukraine. What the Soviets want to do is they want to take Ukraine, this breadbasket of Europe, this very fertile territory, and exploit it to industrialize the rest of the country. The Nazis, on the other hand, have the idea that their country is essentially industrial enough already. What they want, or what Hitler personally wants, this is in Mein Kampf and in his second book, what Hitler personally wants is an eastern frontier empire, an agrarian pastoral utopia, this Garden of Eden, that is his term, as you say, in which Ukraine would balance, so to speak, the already industrialized Central and Western Europe. And in Hitler's view, what all of Stalin's work was to be undone. The Soviet cities were to be razed, the Soviet urban populations were to be starved to death, all the Jews were to be eliminated, and these lands were to be restored to a kind of colonial backwardness. There were two visions, each of them involving agriculture, and each of them overlapping precisely in Ukraine, which is why more people die in Ukraine than anywhere else in the world in the 1930s and 1940s.
Then there's the joint invasion in 1931. I mean, the Soviets and the Nazis both invade Poland.
This is crucial in a lot of different ways. One of them is that it's important for us to just remember that the Second World War began as a German-Soviet alliance. That can be interpreted in various ways, but when we forget that, when we start the war in 1941, in June from a Russian point of view, or in December from an American point of view, we're leaving out the very awkward business that these ideological foes were in fact allies for the better part of 2 years. It's also very important because 1939 is the moment when German terror catches up to Soviet terror. What we've been talking about thus far has mostly been a kind of first stage in the book, where almost all of the killing is carried out by the Soviets. In the 1930s, from 33 to 38, say, the Soviets are killing on the scale of millions. The Germans are killing on the scale of hundreds or thousands, which is, of course, horrible, but it's a completely different scale from what's happening in the Soviet Union. With the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact and the joint invasion of Poland, what you see is the Germans catching up. You see them developing institutions of death, like the Einsatzgruppen, who are later to be so notorious in the invasion of the Soviet Union. And you see both powers killing in Poland on the scale of a couple hundred thousand. In other words, the war allows the violence of Germany to ramp up to a significant degree.
What is Einsatzgruppen?
Einsatzgruppe just means a task force, so it sounds like a very neutral thing, but the Einsatzgruppen in the context of the Second World War were special units which were created mostly from policemen with a few SS men, sometimes other forces as well, whose job was to pacify the territory behind the front lines. They were first used in Austria and Czechoslovakia, where there wasn't really a real war, and so they didn't actually carry out any atrocities to speak of. But in Poland, the Einsatzgruppen were tasked with, among other things, eliminating the Polish intelligentsia, that is to say, the educated classes which were associated with cultural and political leadership in that country. And what's interesting here is that both the Germans and the Soviets actually had that same idea with respect to Poland. The Einsatzgruppen on the one side, and then the Soviet secret police, the NKVD, on the other side, were engaged with physically eliminating the Polish intelligentsia, because both the Germans and the Soviets, like the Poles themselves for that matter, had the idea that there was this leading layer of society that was, so to speak, at the avant-garde avant-garde of the nation. And the cruel idea that held the Germans and the Soviets together was that that could be eliminated, and therefore the Polish nation could be destroyed from the German point of view, or it could be mastered from the Soviet point of view.
Now go to 1941, when the Germans invade Russia. How does that change or ramp up the killing in the Bloodlands?
The tempting thing to do with Operation Barbarossa, which is, of course, one of the most, if not the most important events of the European 20th century, the tempting thing to do is to imagine the hundreds of thousands of soldiers crashing across into the Soviet Union. This is the largest offensive in the history of the world. It's not just Germans either. It's Italians and Slovaks and Spaniards and Finns and Hungarians and Romanians. It's a tremendous offensive. The narrative temptation to which most books on the Second World War succumb is to write about that at the beginning. And I do write about that. But I actually stop in the middle of the book before 1941 and talk about political economy, which seems like an odd diversion, but it's important for the reasons that you already raised, namely that the Germans have these plans for the Soviet Union, which are horrifyingly, catastrophically disruptive in scope. They imagine four things are going to happen when they invade the Soviet Union. First, they imagine a blitzsieg, a lightning victory, in which the Wehrmacht is going to overwhelm the Red Army within 9 to 12 weeks and thereby destroy the Soviet state. They also imagine, this is the second thing, a hunger plan, according to which they intend deliberately, and they write this down, to starve about 30 million Soviet citizens to death in the first winter of the war. The third thing they have in mind is a colonization plan known as Generalplan Ost, according to which in the years and decades after the war, they are going to disperse, deport, assimilate, enslave, or kill the remnants of the Soviet population so that this agrarian colony that we were talking about can be created. And then the final thing that they intend to do, although they're not sure just how they're going to achieve it at this point, is to eliminate the Jews of Eastern Europe. The basic idea seems to be, at this point, in the summer of 41, to drive them murderously eastward into some place where they won't be able to survive and to enslave some of them. That idea hasn't yet been finalized at this point. I'd stop and describe all of this because it shows a relationship between Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union. Much of what the Nazis were up to was trying to reverse bloodily, painfully, what the Soviets had done. The Nazi vision of this part of Eastern Europe was exactly the opposite of the Soviet vision. It shouldn't be modern. It should be precisely demodernized. It should be returned to its primeval, attractive backwardness so that the master German race, this is the idea, can go out there to the east and prove their manhood, establish their virility, and reproduce the race, and so on and so forth. It's also important for another reason, because the crimes that the Germans commit after 1941 are greater in scale than anything that has come before. And the way to understand those crimes, I think, is to try to show how their initial plans ran into reality and how they improvised, pushing some of them forward and bringing some of them back. So with the hunger plan, they couldn't starve 30 million people because you require a huge amount of social control to do something like that. And they didn't really have that. But they did starve where they did have control. For example, in prisoner of war camps, where they starved about 2.5 million people in the second worst war crime they committed after the Holocaust.
Describe that, these prisoners standing straight, surrounded by barbed wire.
The telling thing about all this is that the Germans didn't really plan for prisoners of war. They had war games which showed how many prisoners of war they would take. In fact, they thought they would take more faster than they did, and they just didn't plan to provide for them, which is it seems like a subtle thing, but that's a terribly murderous policy. The entire history of the law and culture of war indicates that you're going to have prisoners of war and the other side is going to have prisoners of war and you have to provide for them in some way. The Germans didn't plan for that. What they were assuming was that they were going to destroy the Soviet state right away and these people were just going to be killed one way or another. So as they win their initial victories in Soviet Ukraine and Soviet Belarus, the soldiers who surrender are marched. And as they march, if they fall down, they're often just shot openly in fields, in the head, something which shocks citizens of the Soviet Union. Even though they've lived under terror, they haven't seen anything like that. Then when they reach their destination, which is often just an open field, they're marched into a facility which isn't even really a facility. There aren't latrines. There isn't a place to prepare food. There's just barbed wire and often an open field. And this is the autumn in a place which is rather cold. And these people are just left there, given no rations or very small rations. And they have to dig holes in the mud. They have to dig caves in order to find some kind of shelter. They find themselves eating the grass or bark off trees, if any such thing is even available. And they begin to die of malnutrition and hunger-related disease and even starvation within the next few months. It's a horrible, horrible scene. And it's gone almost entirely unportrayed, at least in the better known literature of the Second World War.
You say that as many prisoners died in one day in the autumn of 1941 as died in the Western American, British, French prisoners died in the whole war.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, you can take any day in October 1941, and more Soviet prisoners of war died on that day than American British prisoners of war died in German custody in the whole war. So these are events on a different scale.
Tim, and also the people who happen to be living in what you call the bloodlands, Ukraine, Belarus, Western Russia, Poland, they're being killed by both Nazis and the Soviets.
This is the striking thing, and this is a kind of fundamental observation, and no matter how you want to interpret it or argue about causality or compare, if you want to compare, there's a kind of underlying social reality here, which I don't think we've gotten our minds around. Just to take the example where we left off, many of the people who were starving to death in German prisoner of war camps in 1941 were survivors of Stalin's starvation policy of 1933, and they compared the two things. They had experienced the two things. Or to take another example, when the Germans begin the Holocaust, when the Germans start shooting Jews on a large scale, which is how the Holocaust begins with large-scale shootings.
Begins when?
The shooting begins of June 1941. Women and children are shot in July of 1941. A large-scale shooting takes place, over 20,000 people, in August. And then in September, a whole Jewish population of a major city, that is Kiev, is eliminated. That's the notorious event at Babi Yar, when 33,761 people are shot. So at some point in the fall of 1941, mass shooting is underway, and by late 1941, Hitler's made it clear, I think, to his closest collaborators that the Jews are to be killed.
But what we think of as the Holocaust comes toward the end of this period, 33-45. There have been many millions of people killed already before what we think of as the Holocaust gets underway.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I was just about to say, that these people had these had experiences which affected how they reacted to things, and I'm afraid not usually in a very good way. So, for example, in 1942, in a place like Kiev, where the Germans had already killed most of the Jews, but they're looking for survivors, people denounce the Jews, and of course, they did that in 1942 just like they had done it in 1938 during the Great Terror, where they denounced other enemies like the Polish ethnic minority. The regime changed and the enemy changed, but the habit of denunciation, that way of dealing with power, was already present. But of course, what you say is true on a much larger scale. The lands where the Holocaust happened, even if the Holocaust hadn't happened there, they would have been the site of the greatest series of mass murders in the modern West. The Holocaust happens on a site where 4 million people had already been killed in previous years. And then if you count the events that take place concurrently with the Holocaust kills, of course, about 6 million people, about 8 million people are killed on these same territories. So there's something important which is happening alongside and in some ways sometimes contributing to the Holocaust itself.
And explain again, the 14 million that are killed are not combat deaths. This is not World War II death. This is political murder carried out against civilians, women, children.
Yeah, I mean, as a couple of people have noted in book reviews, in some way the story is much darker than I tell it. I note in passing that the Bloodlands were also where the largest and arguably the decisive battles of the Second World War took place. And of course, the Red Army took casualties on an almost impossible scale. No one really knows what the scale was, but we do know that it was far, far larger than anywhere else. And as a rough estimation, as many men died on battlefields in the Bloodlands, just in the Bloodlands, as died during the Second World War in the rest of the world. I don't just mean in Europe, I mean including the Pacific theater and every other theater of war. And that, you know, roughly speaking, that doubles the death toll on these territories, although of course many of the soldiers were not from these territories. So if anything, the story, you could write a book which would be darker than this one, although I wouldn't wish to be the one who did that.
What you've done is write a very fine and very dark book indeed. Thank you, Timothy Snyder, for speaking with us today about the 20th century apocalypse planned and carried out by both Hitler and Stalin. I'm Lewis Lapham of Lapham's Quarterly for Bloomberg News. Copyright Bloomberg 2011. Tim, I'm sorry we didn't have more time.
Very glad we could do it.
It's a wonderful book.